This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Due to the graphic nature of this investigation and trial, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of child sexual assault that some people may find offensive and may be upsetting for some listeners. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13. If you are aware of a child who is being abused or neglected, you can report this to the National Child Abuse Hotline, reachable at 1-800-4-A-CHILD. Which is 1-800-422-4453. You can also visit childwelfare.gov for state-by-state resources for reporting child abuse or neglect. In the fall of 1984, a shocking story rippled through the working-class town of Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Bernie Barron, a 19-year-old teacher's aide, was accused of sexually abusing a 3-year-old boy. In the following days, 5 more children at the Early Childhood Development Center came forward with similar claims of abuse. Bernie was arrested and charged with 6 counts of indecent assault and 6 counts of rape. The entire case rested on the statements of the 6 children, all between the ages of 3 and 5 years old. But their stories were inconsistent, changing from interview to interview. At times, they flat out denied the abuse took place. It made prosecutor Dan Ford hesitant to move forward with a trial. Shortly after Bernie's arrest, Ford offered him a plea bargain. If he confessed to the abuse, he would spend only 5 years in prison. If they proceeded to court, Ford promised Bernie he would spend the rest of his life behind bars. But Bernie refused. He would not admit to something he didn't do. Instead of taking the deal, he put his trust in the system and his future in the hands of the jury. How should we determine a person's guilt? Do we defer to the evidence discovered by police or the verdict reached by a jury? And what happens when the evidence and the verdict don't line up? Hi, I'm Vanessa Richardson, and this is Not Guilty, a Parcast original. Each week, we look at complicated criminal cases that test the limits of innocent until proven guilty. Today, we're continuing our discussion of the Bernie Barron daycare abuse case. Last week, we discussed the nationwide panic over daycare abuse and how those fears came home to roost at the Early Childhood Development Center, or ECDC, in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. We covered the police investigation into the accusations against Bernie Barron and why he was eventually arrested. This week, we'll follow the criminal trial and see how the evidence against Bernie was presented to the jury. We'll also discuss new evidence and new scientific understanding that put the entire case into question. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. In order to protect the victim's privacy in this case, various pseudonyms were used in police investigations and in court. For these episodes, we will also be using the pseudonyms for the victims and their parents most commonly used in court documents. This includes Peter and Julie Haynes, Judith and Gina Smith, Stephen and Richard Thompson, Leanne and Annie Bailey, Virginia Stone, and John Larson. 19-year-old Bernie Barron spent Thanksgiving and Christmas of 1984 in jail, waiting for his trial to begin. His working-class family was unable to post his $15,000 bail, but did manage to scrape together enough money to hire defense attorney Leonard Conway. But before this case could go in front of a jury, presiding judge William Simons had to determine if the six accusing children were competent to testify. The youngest child was barely 3 years old, and the oldest was five. Simons wanted to be certain that they were all capable of understanding the difference between lying and telling the truth. Judge Simons brought the children, one by one, to his chambers. Three of the six children demonstrated that they clearly knew the truth from a lie. But four-year-old Peter Haynes did not cooperate. Peter was the first child to accuse Bernie of abuse and was known at ECDC as a handful. As soon as Peter entered Judge Simons' chambers, he refused to sit down. Instead, he played with the blinds, asked the judge about his pipe, and climbed on the furniture. Though Judge Simons tried repeatedly, he could not get Peter to answer any questions directly. The youngest accuser, three-year-old Annie Brown, answered the judge's questions, but struggled to demonstrate an understanding of truthfulness. She said it's both good to tell the truth and also good to not tell the truth. When Judge Simons asked Gina Smith, another three-year-old, if it was a good thing or a bad thing to tell the truth, she ignored the question and replied instead, "Bernie touched me." While expressing some reservations about Annie and Peter's competency, Judge Simons did eventually declare all six children fit to testify. The trial would move forward as scheduled on January 23, 1985. In the days leading up to the trial, Bernie Barron tried to push away the doubts he had about his defense lawyer, Leonard Conway. Over the last 3 months, Bernie had trouble getting in touch with his lawyer. Calls from the jail had to be made collect, but Conway refused to accept the charges. He only visited Bernie twice at the jail and only talked to him on the phone one or two times. Bernie had never worked with an attorney before. He wondered if this was normal, but he couldn't imagine how his lawyer was preparing for trial without talking to him. In addition, when Conway requested to see the videotaped police interviews of Bernie's accusers, he was only given two tapes, and both were edited. One tape showed pieces of Peter Haynes' interview, and the other was the compilation of clips shown to the grand jury. Though Peter and the other children had all repeatedly denied Bernie abused them, these statements were cut from both tapes. Conway didn't even notice that the interviews had been edited. Bernie pointed it out to the lawyer the day before the trial. Even after learning this, Conway didn't ask to review the full tapes. It also appeared Conway didn't do much to prepare. He didn't interview anyone on the prosecution's witness list before the trial, and his own witness list was sparse. Prepared or not, the trial began on January 23, 1985. In his opening statement, ADA Dan Ford prepared the jury to hear the truth straight from the children. He explained how each child came forward, one at a time, to independently report their abuse. With the support of expert testimony, the state would make it clear that Bernie Barron molested these children. They would argue he had all the opportunity he needed when he was left alone with the children during the school day. Defense attorney Leonard Conway warned the jurors in his opening statement that the accusations were nothing more than the result of prejudice and hysteria. Conway said that the evidence would show that Bernie simply did not have the opportunity to abuse these children at ECDC. He stressed to the jury that Bernie Barron was not guilty. But ADA Ford didn't agree with Conway's assessment that Bernie never had the chance to be alone with the children. he called several ECDC teachers to the stand. They explained that they left Bernie alone in the classroom when they had to go to meetings or needed to get something from the office. He did have the opportunity to abuse the kids while the other adults were out of the room. However, on cross-examination, they all conceded that he was generally not alone with the children for more than a few minutes at a time. They also never saw anything in Bernie's behavior with the kids that they thought was questionable. But Conway continued to show signs that he wasn't up to the task of Bernie's defense. When Jane Trumpy, the director of ECDC, described Bernie's duties at the school and which children he instructed, Conway missed a huge opportunity. One of the accusers was never assigned to Bernie's classroom, and they had no interaction with each other at all. But in the jumble of names, dates, and classroom numbers, the defense failed to point this discrepancy out to the jury. After the adults, the children were called to testify. The entire case rested on what they would or would not say in front of the jury. Judge Simons decided that the children would testify while seated on the floor rather than in the witness box so that they would not have to see Bernie while they spoke. He also cleared the courtroom of all spectators, so when Peter Haynes walked in to testify, one of the few faces he recognized was Bernie's. He ran over to the defense table and said hello. As ADA Ford quickly pulled Peter away, the four-year-old spat curse words. Ford managed to settle Peter on the floor in front of the prosecution table, but he proved to be predictably uncooperative. Peter refused to answer most questions. When he did answer, he was contrary. He denied the abuse, and then he denied knowing who Bernie was, in spite of just having greeted him by name a few minutes before. Eventually, Peter was dismissed. Then, 3-year-old Gina Smith took the stand, wearing a church dress and ribbons in her hair. Her accusations of abuse had grown more and more elaborate since the initial disclosure in October of 1984. She had since told her therapist that Bernie raped her with scissors, causing her to bleed. Then, to cover up the source of the blood, Bernie stabbed her in the foot. However, ECDC couldn't find an injury report to verify this claim. And when ADA Ford tried to lead Gina through her retelling of the incident with the scissors, she first said she forgot what happened. Eventually, Ford was able to coach Gina through her memory, and she echoed what she said to her therapist. She described a traumatic rape with a pair of scissors, and the jurors were brought to tears. After Gina, 4-year-old Richard Thompson was called to testify. Like Gina and Peter, he sat on the floor. The first few times ADA Ford asked him to describe the abuse, Richard denied it. He said Bernie didn't touch him. But when Ford gave him an anatomically correct doll and asked again, Richard pointed to the doll's genital area. Throughout his testimony, every time Ford asked him if Bernie did something, Richard said no the first time, and then yes the second. Not only did Leonard Conway fail to object to these inconsistencies, but he also left other major stones unturned. Richard accused Bernie of touching him while they were in the woods. However, there were no woods surrounding ECDC. Richard also alleged that Bernie abused him while playing hide-and-seek in a storage shed near the playground. But the shed was locked at all times, and Bernie didn't have a key. Instead of focusing on these details, Conway asked Richard more general questions about truthfulness, perhaps trying to keep things as simple as possible for the young boy. He asked if the stories Richard told his parents, the police, and ADA Ford were real or made up. The 4-year-old replied, "Fake stories." Coming up, the testimony of the young accusers continues. Now back to the story. In January of 1985, 19-year-old Bernie Barron stood trial for the alleged assault and abuse of six preschool children. However, when the young witnesses took the stand, their testimony was inconsistent, and some of the details they mentioned weren't true. For example, 4-year-old John Larson testified that Bernie led him deep into the woods one afternoon. He said they walked very far in the snow. However, John was only in Bernie's classroom for 2 months during the summer, not when there was snow on the ground. Defense attorney Leonard Conway failed to attack these specific points, but he did ask John about his truthfulness. John said he sometimes made up stories. After the children, ADA Ford called pathologist Dr. Jeffrey Ross to testify about 4-year-old Peter Haynes's positive gonorrhea test. To Ford, Peter could only have tested positive for an STD if he'd been sexually abused. Yet, in his varied descriptions of abuse, Peter never mentioned oral rape. In addition, Bernie tested negative for gonorrhea. But Dr. Ross explained on the stand that someone can test negative as soon as 24 hours after treatment for gonorrhea. Even though Bernie's medical records did not show he had been treated, he could have seen someone other than his regular doctor. Penicillin was the usual treatment at the time. Ross even suggested that Bernie could have used someone else's leftover medication. And to punctuate the link between Bernie and the STD, Dr. Ross testified that gonorrhea occurs more often in, quote, prostitutes and male homosexuals. Bernie's mother sat in the gallery, listening to Dr. Ross's testimony, frustrated she couldn't speak up. Even if gay men had gonorrhea more often, she knew it was impossible that Bernie was treated for the disease quickly or easily because he was allergic to penicillin. But evidence of Bernie's allergy was never entered into the record. After Dr. Ross, ADA Ford brought psychotherapist Jane Satullo from the Rape Crisis Center to the stand. She personally interviewed the children after the first accusations were made and testified about their veracity. But her testimony was contradictory. First, she listed some signs of sexual abuse in children, such as touching their own genitals, wetting the bed, and acting out. But on cross-examination, she conceded that many of those behaviors are also seen in non-abused children. Satullo also testified that if a child repeats the same details in each retelling, the story of abuse must be true. But on cross-examination, Conway pointed out the inconsistencies. These children were not repeating the same details over and over again. But Satullo brushed it off. The added details were part of the process of disclosure. As the child opened up, they felt more comfortable and gave more information. She assured the jury that there had never been any cases of young children making false accusations. In truth, studies have consistently shown that children do occasionally make false accusations, oftentimes prompted by leading and suggestive questioning tactics. Finally, ADA Ford brought 3-year-old Gina Smith's psychiatrist to the stand. She recounted Gina's confession about Bernie assaulting her with a pair of scissors. Gina told her how Bernie, quote, scraped the blood out of her. To punctuate her testimony, Ford next brought Dr. Jean Shealy to the stand. Dr. Shealy had physically examined 3 of the children, including Gina. In her exam, Dr. Shealy found notches in Gina's hymen, leading her to believe that Gina had been raped, possibly by an object. Bernie later recalled that while one doctor was testifying, Conway slid a notebook over to him and whispered, "I can't think of any questions. Write down any you think of." After Dr. Shealy's statements, ADA Ford rested his case. But before Leonard Conway presented his defense, Judge Simons adjusted the charges against Bernie. he dismissed the charges in relation to Peter Haynes, even though he was Bernie's first accuser. He had not testified that anything had happened. Simons also threw out the rape charge brought by John Larson. A rape conviction requires penetration to have occurred, and John said nothing on the stand to support this. After dismissing the charges related to Peter, Judge Simons instructed the jury to disregard all of the testimony that related to him. This included the disturbing information that he contracted gonorrhea of the throat. But as the saying goes, you can't unring a bell. Because of this, most defense attorneys would have asked for a mistrial, arguing that it was impossible for the jury to simply forget they heard this evidence. However, Conway made no such motion. For the third time, ADA Dan Ford presented Bernie with the same 5-year plea deal. However, he added the provision that he could serve his time in county jail rather than in state prison. But Bernie again refused. He felt confident in his case, especially now that Peter's charges were dismissed. But the next morning, as defense attorney Leonard Conway prepared to start his defense, Bernie saw the list of witnesses he intended to call. It concerned him that there were no experts on the list, no one who would call into question the reliability of the children's changing and inconsistent stories. But Conway told Bernie not to worry about it. First on the stand for the defense was Richard Herman, the custodian at ECDC, and the school's only other male employee. He testified that the shed, where some of the abuse allegedly occurred, was always locked. In fact, the only person who did have access to the shed was Richard. In his questioning, without directly accusing Richard, Conway strongly implied that the custodian might have been the person to abuse the children. Bernie's close friend, Dolly Haywood, also testified. Conway didn't include her on his original witness list, but Bernie insisted that he add her. She was the closest thing he had to an alibi witness. Many of the accusations against Bernie occurred at nap time, but that was when Bernie took his lunch break, and he always spent his lunch break at Dolly's house near ECDC. They ate lunch together and watched the soap opera Days of Our Lives. Despite ADA Ford's objections, Dolly was allowed to testify to such. Conway then called Bernie's sister, Sharon, to the stand. Bernie often babysat her 3 young children. She told the jury that she trusted Bernie and didn't believe that he would hurt them or any other child. She testified that after Bernie's arrest, the Department of Social Services had also investigated the possibility that Bernie had abused her children. But before Sharon could tell the jury the results of the investigation, ADA Ford objected, classifying the testimony as irrelevant. The DSS found no signs of abuse, yet Conway did not try any other way to include this information in Bernie's defense. But Bernie's best advocate was perhaps himself. He took the stand wearing the same navy blue suit he had worn every day of the trial. Bernie calmly denied the accusations against him and explained his schedule at ECDC. He simply never had the opportunity to be alone with any of the children. But Ford's cross-examination of Bernie was relentless. He threw each individual accusation at him, but as Ford attempted to rile him up, Bernie remained even-tempered and continued to deny any and all abuse. Ford pivoted and asked Bernie questions about his relationship with his boyfriend. Then he pointedly asked if Bernie enjoyed working with children. Ford was leaning on the bigoted idea that a gay man who wanted to work with children must be a pedophile. Bernie refused to rise to this bait and answered Ford's questions with short answers. He asked Bernie if he'd ever been treated for a sexually transmitted disease. This line of questioning was irrelevant now that Peter Haynes' charges had been dropped, but Leonard Conway didn't object. Instead, Bernie admitted he was treated for a sexually transmitted disease a few years previously, but he didn't know if it was gonorrhea. After Bernie testified, the defense rested. In his closing statement, Conway repeated much of what he'd already said. This was a case of prejudice against Bernie and then hysteria on the part of the other parents. In contrast, Ford's closing statement was described by the media as theatrical. He told the jury that he could say nothing that would be more convincing than the testimony of the children. And if some of the details of their stories had changed over time, it was only because the children had been too scared to confess everything at first. Then he walked the jury through the children's testimony. Well, the parts of the testimony that implicated Bernie. Because the charges related to Peter were dismissed, Ford should not have mentioned Peter at all. But he brought up Peter's gonorrhea test, again saying that Bernie had time to treat it prior to being tested, and that Bernie was at a higher risk of gonorrhea due to his, quote, lifestyle. Ford told the jury that Bernie Barron was, quote, like a chocoholic in a candy store, and indeed, for him, perpetrating these despicable acts was like taking candy from a baby. After 3.5 hours of deliberations, the jury returned with their verdict. Bernie looked straight ahead with his hands folded when it was read. On 5 counts of indecent assault and battery, and 3 counts of non-forcible rape of a child, he was found guilty. The only charge he was found not guilty of was the rape relating to Annie Brown. He was led from the courtroom in handcuffs, stoic. When his mother went to the holding room to see him immediately afterward, his resolve had left him. He began shaking. At sentencing on January 31, 1985, ADA Dan Ford asked the judge to give Bernie Barron 2 consecutive life sentences, making him ineligible for parole for 30 years. Bernie, then 19, would be nearly 50 before he could get out of prison. Judge Simons allowed the parents of 2 of the accusers to give impact statements. They spoke about the long-term impact of the assaults on their children. Their words were thick with grief, and it was clear that they truly believed in Bernie's guilt. But one parent who was not convinced was Melinda Ward. Her son attended ECDC and was in Bernie's classroom. She told Judge Simons how Bernie had taken her son under his wing when he arrived at the school, nonverbal and struggling to connect with other children. She said she saw changes in her son thanks to Bernie's intervention. Bernie, who sat through all of the trial and sentencing hearing without showing any emotion, began to cry as Melinda said he was not the monster he was being made out to be. She called him a miracle worker. Coming up, Judge Simons hands down Bernie's sentence. Now back to the story. In January of 1985, 19-year-old Bernie Barron faced life in prison after his conviction on 8 charges related to the sexual abuse of children. Bernie's attorney, Leonard Conway, pled for a more lenient sentence and for Bernie to be sent to county jail rather than state prison. Judge William Simons took the arguments of both sides into consideration. Then he sentenced Bernie to the maximum, even more time than ADA Ford had recommended, 3 life sentences and 5 8- to 10-year sentences, all to run concurrently. Bernie would be eligible for parole in 15 years, but he would have to spend that time in a maximum security prison. Bernie, 19 years old and weighing roughly 100 pounds, was sent to Walpole State Prison, one of the most dangerous prisons in the United States at the time. Prisoners who are convicted of serious offenses against children are often put in protective custody, they're at a greater risk of retribution attacks, both physical and sexual, from other inmates. Instead, Bernie was released into the general population. His attorney told the media that Bernie's life sentence would likely be a short one due to the violence he knew would occur. Within 4 days at Walpole, Bernie was sexually and physically assaulted. His mother and stepfather, desperate to get him out of there, used every dime they had to hire an attorney for Bernie's direct appeal. This appeal was denied in March of 1986, and the Supreme Judicial Court refused to hear further arguments. Short of discovering new evidence, Bernie would not have another chance at freedom until he was eligible for parole. But he would only be released if he admitted his guilt and accepted responsibility for the crimes he was convicted of. 22-year-old Bernie, having lost all hope, attempted suicide in March of 1988 after a particularly brutal attack by another inmate. After he recovered physically from his attempt, he was sent to Bridgewater Treatment Center to be evaluated. Bridgewater was where inmates deemed as sexually dangerous were housed. Ironically, Bernie was safer at Bridgewater than he had ever been at Walpole. Because all of the inmates there had been convicted of serious sexual offenses, the prison hierarchy that made him an easy target at Walpole did not apply at Bridgewater. Bernie wanted to stay there, but to do so, he needed to be open to treatment. In his first interview, Bernie stubbornly insisted on his innocence and refused to say he was a pedophile, even if it meant going back to Walpole. 2 weeks later, another doctor wrote in a report that Bernie confessed his guilt to him and said he was ready to comply with treatment. Bernie denied he ever said this. While detractors would point to this report as evidence of Bernie's guilt, it allowed him to stay at Bridgewater, likely saving his life. While it looked like Bernie's legal process was over, it was just beginning for ECDC. In May of 1985, Marcia Stone, mother of accuser Virginia Stone, filed a civil suit against ECDC for $750,000, claiming they were negligent for hiring Bernie. 2 months later, her friend Julie Haynes, the mother of the first accuser, filed a suit for $3.2 million on the same grounds. The two cases were eventually joined together. Like most businesses, ECDC was insured against lawsuits, and the insurance company put their top lawyers to work to fight this. What the lawyers uncovered put the entire case against Bernie into question. The first major bombshell was a Department of Social Services report from October of 1985, just 9 months after Bernie's conviction. It stated that shortly after the trial, 5-year-old Virginia told her therapist that Bernie never actually molested her. She said her mother told her that she needed to say he did so that they could get money and toys. While this recantation was reported to the Department of Social Services, Bernie's appellate attorneys were never told. In addition, Bernie wasn't the only person that Virginia accused of assaulting her. She also made allegations against her mother's boyfriend, but this wasn't included in the transcript of her interview with police. ECDC's lawyers also discovered that Virginia wasn't the only child to make multiple accusations. Shortly before Bernie's trial, Peter Haynes told his foster mother that one of his mother's boyfriends had sexually abused him. Though a report supporting the validity of these accusations was filed before the trial and should have been sent to the DA immediately, Social Services waited until after Bernie's trial to send the report. And again, this was never given to anyone on Bernie's appeal team. In the summer of 1988, both Julie and David Haynes were deposed in preparation for the lawsuit against ECDC. In the interview, they both admitted to prejudice against gay men, and David admitted he was no longer sure Bernie was guilty. While waiting for the civil case to go to trial, Virginia Stone's mother died. Her attorneys ended up settling with ECDC for a small sum instead of moving forward with the proceedings. Julie Haynes, however, took her case all the way to trial. On April 5, 1995, Peter and Julie Haynes both testified. But ECDC's lawyers destroyed Julie's credibility, and she agreed to a settlement the next day. While the exact amount has not been reported, it was far, far below the millions she was seeking. Jocelyn Sedney, an attorney for ECDC's insurance company, investigated Bernie's case in preparation for the civil trial for years. The more she uncovered, the more she realized that an innocent man had been sent to prison. But she wasn't a criminal attorney, so she wasn't the best person to advocate for Bernie. Instead, she looked for someone to take on Bernie's case with the new evidence she had uncovered. Knowing that this would be Bernie's last shot at exoneration, she needed to make sure she found the right person. In 1999, 14 years after Bernie's conviction, Jocelyn connected with a man named Bob Chattel, who had already advocated for Bernie's innocence for the last 2 years. Bob connected her with John Swamley, a talented criminal defense attorney. With the information uncovered during the civil trial in hand, the fight to get Bernie Barron out of prison began in earnest. Bernie's legal team hit roadblocks almost immediately. The original defense case file was gone. Bernie's trial attorney, Leonard Conway, had turned the entire thing over to the appellate attorney. Once the appeal was denied, they destroyed the file. John Swamley started from scratch, requesting various items from the Berkshire County District Attorney, including the video interviews of the children. In October of 2001, a judge ordered that the materials be turned over, but the district attorney's office claimed they couldn't find the original tapes. They continued to claim ignorance until finally, in June of 2004, Swamley filed a lawsuit against the DA, asking the courts to compel the office to turn over the requested materials. 3 weeks later, after 3 years of claiming the materials were missing, the DA called Swamley. He had just found several of the videotapes mismarked in a box that contained videos from DUI stops. Swamley saw the videotapes as his smoking gun. All the children spent the majority of their interviews denying any abuse happened. They only made accusations against Bernie after multiple prompts and suggestions from the adults questioning them. Some of the children even accused other people of abusing them before they named Bernie. Swamley called in Dr. Maggie Bruck, an expert on the reliability of child testimony, to view the complete tapes. In her affidavit, she stated that the tapes showed inappropriate interviewing techniques. The interviewers were so suggestive that they tainted any future information the children could testify to. Bernie's legal team learned that it wasn't just the method of questioning that had been debunked. Much of the physical evidence from the case had also been proven inaccurate in the years after Bernie's conviction. The throat culture used on Peter Haynes to test for gonorrhea had a high false positive rate in children due to different bacteria that children often carried. The tiny notches in Gina Smith's hymen, believed to be caused by penetration, were found in a significant percentage of children who had not been raped, and are considered a normal variation. Not only did it look like Bernie did not abuse any of these children, but his legal team also came to believe that most of the children hadn't been molested by anyone at all. Instead, they simply parroted back the suggestions of abuse provided by the adults around them. Unfortunately, this new science wasn't much help in the motion for a new trial. In a similar daycare abuse case in Massachusetts, the appellate court made a controversial ruling stating that new science was not always relevant in appeals due to the community's need for finality. The court was essentially saying that cases couldn't be brought back to the appellate court every time scientific understanding changed. Bernie's appeal team also alleged prosecutorial misconduct against ADA Dan Ford for withholding the complete videotapes. But a few years after Bernie was convicted, prosecutor Ford became a judge. Bernie's lawyers knew that no judge would be eager to call out a colleague in an official ruling, so appealing on those grounds was unlikely. So instead, they focused on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim based on the many errors Leonard Conway made in his defense. And it worked. In June of 2006, over two decades after his conviction, Bernie Barron was granted a new trial. Now that Bernie's conviction had been thrown out, he was eligible for bail. It was set at $50,000, and on June 30th, 2006, 41-year-old Bernie calmly walked out of the jailhouse with his mother by his side. When his friends, family, and supporters began to cheer, Bernie couldn't hold back the tears. For the first time in 21 years, he was not behind bars. But Bernie wasn't completely free. In addition to the conditions of his bond, the fear of going back to prison still hung over him. The district attorney told the media that he would appeal the ruling for a new trial and, if necessary, he would take Bernie back to court. But when the appellate court upheld the order for a new trial in May of 2009, the DA announced he would not seek a new trial after all. He said that he believed Bernie Barron was guilty. But after so many years, the memories of the victims had faded. He worried about the damage of bringing them back up for those who had healed from the trauma. The charges against Bernie were dropped. Bernie Barron was now finally and truly a free man. Bernie's story is only one in a litany of false daycare abuse claims during the hysteria of the 1980s and early 1990s, but he was the first one to be successfully prosecuted, and he was one of the last ones to prove his innocence and walk free. Bernie stayed in Massachusetts, but never lived in Berkshire County again. On September 1, 2014, 49-year-old Bernie suffered a fatal brain aneurysm at the home he shared with his partner and died before paramedics could arrive. Bob Chattel, one of Bernie's first advocates, continues to maintain a website dedicated to Bernie's fight to prove his innocence. It can be found at freebarron.org. At the site, Bob writes, quote, "It's frightening to realize that we live in a society where such terrible things can happen to a decent and gentle person such as Bernard Barron. But what would be even more terrible would be to live in such a society where few were willing to try to help. Let Bernard Barron's legacy be a kinder and more just world." Thanks for listening to Not Guilty. We'll be back Thursday with a new case to explore. You can find more episodes of Not Guilty, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or your favorite podcast directory. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. See you next week. Not Guilty was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Libeskind. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Not Guilty was written by Charlie Worrell. I'm Vanessa Richardson.